So, 2 Kings chapter 8. 2 Kings chapter 8. We'll get to the questions in a few minutes. Don't put them away. 2 Kings chapter 8, verse 1. Elisha spoke to the woman whose son had been restored to life, saying, "Arise and go to your household, go with your household, and sojourn wherever you can sojourn. For the Lord has called a famine, and it will even come to the land for 7 years." So the woman arose and did according to the word of the man of God. She went with her household to sojourn in the land of the Philistines for 7 years. At the end of the 7 years, the woman returned from the land of the Philistines. She went out to appeal to the king for her house and for her field. Now the king was talking with Gehazi. Remember that guy? We remember where we left him, or where he left us, you could say. The man of God, the servant of the man of God, saying, "Please relate to me all the things that Elisha has done." And as he was relating to the king how he had restored to life the one who was dead, Gehazi was wishing that he had never given it all up. After all, prophet of God or pathetic king? Who would you rather hang with? In fact, this does say something. It might say something. Okay, Gehazi is now with the king. All right, I am guessing, that this is a total guess, that Gehazi is able to access the king now because of who he was earlier. I could be wrong with that. But I'm guessing that he has always had this privileged position, and that's exactly the point. He always had privilege. And yet he goes while he has this privilege, and he's greedy and wants more. In fact, as I said a minute ago, prophet of God or pathetic king, who would you rather be with? Prophet of God. Yet he goes, he has one of the most privileged positions ever, and he throws it all away. Some people will throw it all away, and what's worse, it's bad enough to throw it all away, but he throws it all away for nothing at all. You remember, what does it profit a man to? But lose his soul. This is exactly what it seems to have happened to God, unless he repented somewhere and we have no indication that he did. What does it profit a man to gain the whole world and forfeit his soul? Note well that Gehazi knew better. As is often the case, isn't it? They just wander off. They give it. They throw it all away. Anybody who has it, throws it away, knows better. So, how do you wake this person up? Gehazi! Is that how you do it? Even if you did take him and shake him, it's not necessarily going to guarantee any results. So when you're dealing with somebody who is in the process of throwing it all away, how do you deal with them? How do you get them to wake up?
Tell them, look, you're going down, you say, or go about it lovingly and gently. But and it's hard to say, it's hard to do like that. It's hard to come across that way. But tell them, look, this is what you're doing, and this is where it's going to end up unless you change. You've got to pay attention.
Back up. Valid points. Back up before that. Do you remember Jude? Jude teaches us. There are several passages all over the Bible, but I'm thinking of three in specific, in particular. Jude tells us, I'll just skip to 19. These are ones who cause divisions, worldly-minded, devoid of the Spirit. But you, beloved, step number one to helping somebody else, build yourself up on your most holy faith. Step number two, praying in the Holy Spirit. Keep yourselves in the love of God, waiting anxiously for the mercy of our Lord Jesus Christ to eternal life. And, now, this is where talks about helping somebody else. Have mercy on some who are doubting. Save others, snatching them out of the fire. And on some have mercy with fear, hating even the garment polluted by flesh. Okay, so first of all, how do you help somebody else? Number one, you remember when you get on the airplane, for those of us who have been on the airplane, and you go through the attendant stands up and says, you just did this, the attendant stands up and says, blah, 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 seatbelt, exits, exits. If in the enlightened likely event of the oxygen disappearing out of the cabin, what comes down? And who do you put it on first? yourself. This is exactly what this is saying. You save yourself. Because if somebody else is dead and you're dying, you can't say, you've got to help yourself first before you can help them. Then it says to pray. Verse 20, praying in the Holy Spirit. By the way, then it goes into, okay, in verse 22, start interacting with the other person. Have mercy on some who are doubting. Save others, snatching them out of the fire. And on some have mercy with fear, hating the garment even polluted by flesh. Do you notice that this person, oops, what happened? This person, the person who is throwing it all away, isn't really in here. They might be, but this person seems to be, look, have mercy on some who are doubting. This is something, you know, I'm just wondering about this passage. I wonder about it. That's not Gehazi. Gehazi wasn't wondering about anything. He was wondering where he'd get some more money, right? Practice your faith. Pray. 1 John 5 also talks about praying. Verse 16. If anyone sees his brother committing a sin not leading to death, he shall ask, and God will for him give life to those who commit a sin not leading to death. There is a sin leading to death. I did not say you should make request for this. All unrighteousness is sin, and there is a sin not leading to death. We could talk about that for a minute, but the real point is, look, if you see somebody, what do? You get down on your hands and knees and you start praying for them. And then, as Ethan was saying earlier, you preach to them. That's what they need. They, you know, shaking them physically, as much as that would be fun, that's not what's going to do it. Preach to them. And in fact, all three of these might not do it either. This is not a guaranteed outcome. What's the only thing that guarantees the outcome? Sorry?
They need to change.
Their hearts need to change. 2 Timothy 2, we brought this up just last time I taught class, actually. Thursday night class. 2 Timothy 2. The Lord's, verse 24, the Lord's patient is bondservant, must not be quarrelsome, patient, kind, able to teach, with gentleness, as John Moore, I think, was saying earlier, and Ethan did too, with gentleness, correcting those who are in opposition. How do you correct them? You reason with them. You say, hey, look at what you're doing. This is dumb. Here's the passage, here's the principle, and this is your practice. You don't want to do that because it's not going to come to a good outlook. Comments or questions on this? Yes, George. He who raises his hand first.
I was going to say, in some senses, some of these things overlap, these three things, because when you interject the relationship between you and this person, and opportunities start. Okay, so my example is, practice your faith is one of them, and while yes, Ethan says you're supposed to be gentle with them, that's true, but when your relationship of like a parent to a child who has done this, sometimes shaking them is what you're allowed to do, and that is part of your own faith.
Yeah. Paul with Peter in Galatians 2. I opposed him to his face in the presence of all. The next time you're assembled together, remove him from your midst. And the language there isn't the gentlest of language, right? So, yeah, valid point. Firm. But still in love, you can be firm and even a little aggressive, although it's mostly defensive, if you will, but still be in love. Yes. I thought somebody else, I remember. Mm-hmm.
I was thinking of Galatians 6, verse 1.
Say it.
Brothers, if anyone is caught in any transgression, you who are spiritual, should restore him in a spirit of gentleness. Keep watch on yourself, lest you too be tempted.
Right. That and first Jude go hand in hand, hating even the garment polluted by the flesh. Practice your faith. You who are, you know, just kind of floating by, barely maintaining your faith. No, you who are spiritual, the strong people. And by the way, does it say those who are older physically and mentally? No. It's who is spiritual, whoever that might be. Sometimes it's the younger, sometimes it's the older. Should be the older always, right? Okay. So back in 2 Kings chapter 8, please relate to me all the things that Elisha has done. He was relating to the king. As he was relating to the king, how he had restored the life of one who was dead, behold, the woman whose son he had restored to life appealed to the king for her house and her field. And Gehazi said, my lord, O king, this is the woman and this is her son whom Elisha restored to life. And the woman looked at him and said, what are you doing with him? Because after all, who did she know? She knew Gehazi. What in the world are you doing with him? But Gehazi, if he's in his right state of mind, at least somewhat, he was ashamed. Because any time somebody who's in sin is called out, knowing that they're in sin, their relationship with somebody isn't right, well, they should feel shame, right? And so the woman here goes back to Elisha and says to Elisha, "Do you know who I saw with the king?" And Elisha says, "No, who?" And she says, "Gehazi. You know Gehazi. You remember that. You've heard of him at least." And they sit down and they have a conversation about Gehazi. Gossip or not? Say it again.
Purpose matters.
Why are you talking about it? Yeah.
Why are you talking about it? Do you remember, how did Paul know what was going on back there in Corinth? Do you remember who? Somebody told him? "I have been informed," verse 11 of 1 Corinthians 1, "I have been informed concerning you, my brethren, by Chloe's people." Oh, she was a gossiper. No.
And do you think there was any doubt in Gehazi's mind that if the situation ever came up, the prophet would talk about it? I mean, Gehazi knew exactly where he was
right
in this. It wasn't like he was left in the dark and, you know, you could have told me. It's not one of those situations.
Right. We assemble to encourage one another. And you know what? We think about, when we're assembled, how we can encourage who? People who aren't here. Those who are lost and those who are... what I meant by those who are lost, those who have never been saved, and those who were saved, but now are lost again. We get together and we talk about, hey, you know, this person's in sin. Remember, Matthew chapter 18 talks about, you bring it to the church. Oh, they're gossiping. Well, purpose matters, right? Not necessarily. So, if there's somebody in a congregation where all the church is talking about them, why?
Exactly, that's the question.
Why? Why are we talking about them? We're trying to help them. Then it is not gossip, no matter what anybody says. It's not gossip. Comments or questions on this? Don't miss the point here. The point is, the big point, I've just talked about minor points that I can get out of the text. The big point is, Jehoram, the king, knew who Jehovah was. He says, "Please relate to me all the great things." He wants to know. Tell me about this God. He knew who Jehovah was. But for him, it was more entertainment, wasn't it? Just tell me, oh yeah, you know, curiosity. Remember Felix, I think it was Felix, maybe Festus, and Herod also. Oh, for a long time, Herod had been wanting to meet this guy, you know. Felix, oh, come back. He'll entertain Paul for 2 years. Oh, fantastic. But it was all mere curiosity. Same thing with here. Whatever Jehoram gets, he knew who God was, and yet he rejected him, he rejects him, he rejects him, he rejects him. Whatever Jehoram gets, he deserves. Unless it's what? What's the only thing that he could get that he doesn't deserve?
Salvation.
Right. Now, we have no indication at all, but even if he had, if later on he repents, like Manasseh didn't deserve it, but yet he'll receive forgiveness. Okay. So the king restores all that's heard. Verse 7. Elisha came to Damascus. Now Ben-Hadad, king of Aram, was sick. By the way, Elisha went where? Who? Damascus. Is that in Israel anywhere? No. God was not just active or not active only in Israel. Here's his man going to another country. So anybody who's read the Bible or not read the Bible, whoever asserts, oh, God was only with the Jews, has not read. It's not all over, but it's there a lot. It's there enough. Okay. The king of Aram was sick, and it was told him. They knew who Jehovah was. That is the point. The man of God has come here. The king said to Hazael, "Take a gift in your hand. Go to meet the man of God, inquire of the Lord by him, saying, will I recover of this sickness?" Do you remember anybody else in this same book who was sick and sent to inquire of a God whether or not they'd be healed? Ahaziah, chapter 1, verses 1 and 2. Moab rebelled against Israel, the death of Ahab. Ahaziah fell through the lattice in his upper chamber, ill. So he sent messengers and said to them, go inquire of Jehovah, the God of Israel. That's not what it says. Go inquire of Baal-zebub, the god of Ekron, whether or not I'll recover from the sickness. So here you have a person in Israel where there is the true God, and a person in Damascus where there is not the true God. And the one in Israel says, no, I'm not going to ask him. I'm going to go over here. And the one in Damascus says, you know where I'm going? I'm going to where there's a real God. And as soon as this king here goes, sends Hazael to where the real God is, or at least to a man of God, he makes Ahaziah look like Ahaziah really was. That others were trying to get God while Ahaziah was trying to get away. How embarrassing for Ahaziah. How crazy of Ahaziah. How damning for him. He knew. Gentiles knew. A Gentile went to this God before he did. And he is so privileged, how damning it is for him. Now, how about every time someone leaves the Lord or his church for another church or God, well, somebody comes in. Marcy and I, in fact, I know you all know the name Evan. Oh, no, this is somebody else. Come to me in a minute. So this young guy out at Purdue. There's a preacher out in Purdue. Isn't it Purdue? Okay. Who? What's the guy's name? It doesn't matter. So this guy, there's college, and there's a big congregation, strong congregation, Ellen Yater. He's the one that's telling us of this. And there's a big congregation, strong congregation, and there's this convert, he comes in, and he's zealous, and then suddenly they don't see him anymore. He'd become a Muslim. Like in a month or two. He had had what was true, and he threw it all away. And what makes it, it's bad on any grounds, but what makes it worse is the fact that there are some who are saying, you had the real God, and you just walked away from him. What are you thinking? Meanwhile, others are saying, I've been searching for years to find the real God. And when they grab onto the real God, they never, ever let go. And every single one that does that makes the one who had the real God and walk away look like a fool, the fool that they really are. So Hazael goes before Elisha, and you've read the text. Elisha says, you're going to be king. Verse 12, Hazael said, why does my Lord weep? Because Elisha was staring at him. And he answered, because I know the evil that you will do to the sons of Israel. Their strongholds you will set on fire. Their young men you will kill with the sword. Their little ones you will dash in pieces. And their women with child you will rip up. Now, we don't ever read of this actually happening. But he'll be king. He'll be the opposing king until chapter 13, about the end of chapter 13. Then Hazael said, what is your servant but a dog that he should do this great thing? And you read the text. Verse 15, on the following day, Hazael took a cover, dipped it in water, and spread it on his face so that he died. And Hazael became king in his place. All right, Hazael becomes king here. Now, skip ahead with me for a moment to chapter 9, verse 1. Elisha the prophet called one of the sons of the prophet, said, gird up your loins, take a flask of oil. Verse 2, search out Jehu the son of Jehoshaphat, the son of Nimshi. Go in, bid him arise, bring him to an inner room. Verse 3, take the flask of oil, anoint it on him. And verse 6, he went, he arose, he went into the house, he poured the oil on his head, and he said, thus says the Lord, the God of Israel, I have anointed you king over the people and the Lord of the Lord, even over Israel. Okay, in chapter 8 and chapter 9, we have two things happen. Hazael, it is told he will become king, and he becomes king. We also have in chapter 9, Jehu becomes king. Do you remember ever reading of Hazael and Jehu becoming kings? You remember reading about that? Chapter 19 of 1 Kings. All right, chapter 19, Elijah runs away from Jezebel. He goes to the mountain. He says, take my life, Lord. I don't want to live anymore. Take my life. And so the Lord comes before him in the small, still wind, and in there is the Lord. Verse 15. The Lord said to him, 1 Kings 19:15. The Lord said to him, go, return you on your way to the wilderness of Damascus, and when you have arrived, you shall anoint Hazael king over Aram, and Jehu the son of Nimshi you shall anoint king over Israel. And Elisha the son of Shaphat, of that guy, you shall anoint as prophet in your place. And it will come about, the one who escapes from the sword of Hazael, Jehu, shall put to death. The one who escapes from the sword of Jehu, Elisha shall put to death. Yea, thou shalt leave 7,000 in Israel. Okay. In 1 Kings 19, Elijah's depressed. Take my life. God says to him, look at who I am. And then he says, I'm going to give you a couple things to do. Number one, go anoint Hazael, go anoint Jehu, and go anoint Elisha. Okay. Elisha shows up in this chapter. But Jehu and Hazael, we don't ever see Elijah go to him, them. We don't see it. Some people say, well, Elijah failed the Lord. Okay? No.
I would just say, Elisha had Elijah's mantle.
Okay.
Elijah was with Elisha. So Elijah gave him double of his spirit or whatever. So he did it.
By proxy.
Yeah.
Okay. Right. Valid. Verse 17. Whatever God meant for Elijah to do, the timing of it all is really revealed in verse 17. It'll come about that the one who escapes from Hazael, Jehu shall put to death. So when Jehu and Hazael and Elisha are all going to be working together. There's something about the timing here. Now, I don't know exactly, like Ethan suggested, that Elijah, by proxy, was the one to anoint Hazael, although Elisha didn't even really anoint Hazael. And then Elisha himself, by proxy, anointed Jehu. Okay. So, people say, look, he failed to do it. No, that misunderstands some things. And even in this verse 17, there's something about whatever God meant, these things would happen at the same time. So, verse 17 helps us understand. Having said that, remember, in chapter 19, Elijah is depressed, discouraged, whatever you want to call it. He says to God, take my life. I don't know what you want to call that, but I'm going to call it discouraged. Anybody ever been discouraged? John hasn't, I guess that's what that laugh is. He doesn't know what it means. Right? Well, everybody's been discouraged. Okay, so what do we do? All right, chapter 19, we said, there's some things in here. First of all, go to God, because that's what he did at the mountain, and God says, here I am. Now we go to God and by reading his word. All right, so go to God, and then we said, go to work. Here, I've got some things for you to do. Go anoint these people. Part of this encouragement is these workers are going to be working. Anoint them, and my will be done through them. That was encouragement for who? Elijah. When did it take place? Okay. I have a question about the timing, because we're going to read about Elijah still. Elijah's still going to send a letter. So something in 2 Chronicles is backwards. Something is. So I'm not ready to say that I was until I read something today, which made me question myself. I'm going to say, Elijah's dead. But I know it's been at least 7 years. Because remember, Elisha told the woman there's going to be a 7-year famine. So the 7-year famine happens. So I know it's at least 7 years. Wait a minute. Think about this. God says, you're discouraged? I've got some encouragement for you. But guess what? It's not actually going to happen until at least 7 years from now, and maybe after you're dead. Well, that's kind of interesting. What does that tell us about how we derive encouragement from God? It has to happen right now. And that's what we're ready for. We live in the now era, right? I pushed send on the way here before I came. Every Thursday night, the last thing I do is push. I open up iTunes so I can communicate with my iPad, and then I automatically wirelessly send my little file to the iPad so I can stick it up there. Well, guess what? It didn't happen this time. So here I am. You know, I'm already running a little late, and I push the button send. Why is it sending? I don't know why it's not sending, but I want it now because that's the way we live. I want my encouragement now. Well, guess what? You'll get your encouragement now. How? The same way Elijah did. It's not going to happen for years, but right now, what did Elijah have? God's word. God said, this is what's going to happen. Elijah, it's not going to happen right now. I don't even know if Elijah knew that. But we have, so the point that we're trying to make here is we derive encouragement from what will happen and simply from God's words. It's not happening right now. It's going to happen. And God told me, and that's what I derive encouragement from. At the same time, we derive encouragement from what has happened. Remember Romans chapter 15, verse 4? Remember this. This is one of the reasons we study the Old Testament. Whatever was written in the earlier times was written for our instruction, so that through perseverance and the encouragement of the Scriptures, we might have hope. Oh, depressed, discouraged, upset, feeling down? What do? Open up the Old Testament. Start reading it. You read about Elijah, who, you know what? Was a man like we are. And then James makes the point that he was a man of faith like we are. And so, like he prayed and it was effective, we ought to pray also and it will be effective. Comments or questions on this? Yes?
Don't you make an argument that kind of contradicts this one in the Italian?
Probably.
In Revelation, it seems like I recall you saying that one of the arguments you can use for whether the prophecy was the fall of Jerusalem or stuff still to come is that why would he be trying to encourage the saints that something wasn't going to happen until way, way later, as in way, way after us now, rather basically be encouraging on something that they would see the fall of Jerusalem? Okay.
Valid point. So in Revelation...
Did you say
that's
that?
Funny. Yeah, basically a point for the date of and the fulfillment dates would be, why would God write, don't worry, everything's going to be okay, to saints 2,000 years from now? Okay. All right, so that's a valid point. It's a valid point that God doesn't necessarily work that way all the time. This is weak, but I would say that I would just note that the saints in Revelation are enduring a bit more than Elijah was. That's all I can think of. Although that's a valid point. I'll have to note that for my notes. But just while we're talking about Revelation, that's like one of the aside supports for the point of the fulfillment. Yeah, it's a good point, though. I'm sorry.
Yeah. If we see that our lives here on earth are not the whole show, that it's just, we're not dead when we die. We're continuing as a part of a communion, of people who live, people who are alive now, and people who will be dead. But we're not dead. So what's going to happen to the Christian church 2,000 years from now should really be very important to us now. So if you see what you were addressing.
Okay. Yeah,
why should we be concerned about, it's not going to happen in 3 generations, I won't be here.
Right, right, right.
But you're...
We should always be concerned for people who are suffering, like Daniel in Daniel chapter 9. And 11, 9 and 11. This is for the end of times. Yet at the end of both of those, Daniel's, and one of them, he's sick for weeks. He's sick because of because of what's going to happen in the future. Right, we should be concerned whether it's happening in the same time, contemporarily with us, or if somebody's hurt, we're concerned. Which is why when you read Job, you say, Job, I'm sorry. And it's why when you read through Revelation and you understand that people are killing people, you think about those Christians who lived back then, and you say, man, I am so sorry that this has happened to you. The fact that it happened back then, 500 years ago, right now, 500 years from now, or 2,000 years from now, we should still be concerned. Good point.
And also be thankful for the fact that we live in relative peace.
And be thankful, and if I may, this is my pet peeve, okay? This is my little soapbox. Sorry. But not only be thankful, a lot, I'm afraid that I and maybe some others have just been thankful. I'm thankful that we live in America and it's so peaceful here. Amen? That's great. But why do we have this peace? We have the peace to use it. It is a tool, it is a resource from God. And God has said that I want you to pray for peace so that people can be saved. That's in Timothy. Good point. Okay. Right. Answers to questions. Anybody bring their answers? Anybody bring their questions? How many folks we got here? John? A couple. Sola's got like notes and notes on the back of her. Okay. All right. I'm just going to ask one question for the sake of fun. Anybody have any questions about the questions or comments about the questions? John Bosworth.
Number four, right?
Oh, number... Yes, that's the one I'm going to bring up. Okay, so nobody else. The question number four is chapter 9. So starting chapter 9. Concerning Ahaziah's death, compare 2 Chronicles 22:7. Okay, so in chapter 9, Jehu kills Ahaziah, the king of Judah. Compare 2 Chronicles 22:7. All right? Let's go ahead and turn there if you don't mind. Now, he was a relative. However, in verse 6, Jehoram returned to be healed in Jezreel. Jehoram is the northern king, of the wounds which they had inflicted on him at Ramah when he fought against Hazael, the king of Aram. And Ahaziah, the son of Jehoram, king of Judah, went down to Jehoram, the son of Ahab, in Jezreel because he was sick. All right, so the northern kingdom king is fighting against Aram, and he gets wounded, and he goes down. And then the southern king, who is actually related, comes up to him and visits him. Now, Jehu kills both the northern king and the southern king. Verse 7 says of 2 Chronicles 22, the destruction of Ahaziah was from God in that. Now, it doesn't say that because he is related, which you would might naturally think, but there's something else going on here. In that, so why, according to God, why did Ahaziah die? In that, he went to Joram, number one. For, when he came, he went out with Jehoram against Jehu, the son of Nimshi, whom the Lord had anointed to cut off the house of Ahab. All right, so northern king gets wounded, southern king comes up to visit him. Jehu kills them both. God says, I killed Ahaziah for one or two reasons. One, because Ahaziah went out to Joram, and he went out with Jehoram against Jehu, the son of Nimshi. All right, so the question was, concerning Ahaziah's death, compare 2 Chronicles 22:7. Why was he killed? Why was Ahaziah killed? And what principles does this underscore? All right, I'll answer the first part. He was killed, according to this passage, because he went to Jehoram, and part of that answer is because he went out against Jehu, whom the Lord had anointed to cut off the house of Ahab. So, why was he killed? Because he went to visit the enemy, number one, and then when he was with the enemy, he tried to stop God's anointed person from doing what God had told him to do. Does everybody agree with that? Okay. So the question is, what principles does this underscore? John Moore. Yes.
Stay away from
more.
Stay away from the sinful people like that, because you're going to get involved in it one way or another.
Yeah. Now, we got to be careful when we're talking here. God did not take us out of the world. The Amish go too far. They stay away from the sinful, from the heathen. Have you been called that yet?
Well, English.
The English. That's right, the English. They stay away from the they stay away from the people. Now, you know, they'll break down the barrier sometime, but go try to talk to one of the women. If I go to the pie stand and try to talk, just have a conversation with the woman selling pies, it ain't going to happen. Because they cannot talk to me. Okay? That's going too far. However, so when we say stay, you said stay away from the sinners. Nobody would be my friend then. but I understand your point. Your point is, okay, what does the word holy mean? Who's holy? So guess what? There is a difference between the Christian who is holy and the unholy. There is a difference. Now, we have to, this doesn't mean we never talk to them, because we got to try to save them. We got to try to get them to be holy. Right? Holy is set apart and holy in their behavior, and so on and so forth. But we often live in a world where the barriers are broken down, and that's no accident. Satan is trying to break down the barriers, but we have to have in our mind there's us and there's them. We were them, and we'd like them to be us, but there is us and there is them, and don't ever forget that. That's one point that this underscores. I think it underscores something else even more, though. Go ahead, John Moore.
Going to the parties, that would be what this is. He went up there to visit with him and socialize, and more likely, as these kings did, have big feasts and parties and stuff. And even in the New Testament, says they were those things.
Right. Something else that I think this underscores, it says it. Verse 7, destruction of Ahaziah was from God. In that, he went to Joram. And when he came, he went out with Joram against Jehu, the son of Nimshi, whom the Lord had anointed to cut off the house of Ahab. Go ahead.
I don't know if you're looking for this, but he didn't seek God and he's trying to find out what God's will was. Well, he certainly wasn't trying to find out what God wanted him to do. He was clearly not interested in it.
I wasn't looking for that. Not explicitly, but implicitly I was. I've written it down. That's illustrated here. But what we see here is God has an agent, and God has sent that agent, and whoever gets in that agent's way, what happened to him? He's killed. Now, does that happen all the time? No, but the principle is don't get in God's way, or one of God's... Remember when Pharaoh Necho goes out against Josiah? Josiah, Pharaoh Necho, this is toward the end. So Pharaoh Necho comes up, and he claims it's from God. Now whether or not, I'll stop, because there's some disagreement whether or not this actually is from God. But the point we see here is that, look, if there's an agent of God's, and he's going somewhere, and he's doing God's work, don't get in his way. Paul writes, 1 and 2 Corinthians, the church in Corinth, there were some in the church in Corinth, I'm just going to shut this, folks.
Where
2 Chronicles 22:7. Paul, the church in Corinth did not, some of the people in the church in Corinth did not accept him as an apostle. And that's why he writes 1 and especially 2 Corinthians. And he says at the end of 2 Corinthians chapter 13, verse 1, this is the third time I'm coming. I previously said that I'm coming. If I come, I will not spare anyone. He said, look, I'm going to tell you exactly what God thinks of you because you are getting in the way of one of his servants. Don't ever get in the way of one of his servants, whether it be a teacher or a doer, a server or a pastor or an elder or whatever it might be. Don't get in God's way. That's what I was hinting at.
I was nowhere near that.
Okay, well, would you...
Nowhere near that.
Okay.
It looks to me like there are two different accounts, and it's tough to reconcile the two. One of them, he's shot in a chariot and dies in the veto.
You're right.
And the other one, where am I? Doesn't really match that.
Okay. I'm not disagreeing. All I was going for was that one verse in verse 7, okay. And what it said there.
The ESV renders that, but it is ordained by God that the downfall of Ahaziah should come about through his going to visit Joram. I don't find the reason in that what you do. That because he went to visit Joram, God was going to kill him. That seems to be what you're saying.
The New American Standard
says in that.
Yeah, it does render it a little differently. 2 Chronicles 22. Yours seems to be God worked out. God was going to have Ahaziah die anyway, and that's how he worked it out.
Yes.
The New American Standard says, in that he went to Joram. So, in the New American Standard, the reason he went to Joram, the reason he died is because he went to Joram. In the ESV, the reason he went to Joram is so that he could die.
In a sense, yeah.
Right.
I'm not sure I read the New American Standard the way you do either. So.
Okay.
But it still seems like the two accounts are not immediately reconcilable. And so when you said, what principle does this...
Oh, so you're going for...
Completely...
Yeah, apologetics?
Huh? Right. Trying to show, is there a way to reconcile the two of them?
Yeah, no, I wasn't even going there.
That's why I think this
which is good.
Look on my
right. Yeah. Okay, that's all for now. From the questions, we're not done. 2 Kings chapter 16, chapter 8, verse 16. In the fifth year of Joram, the son of Ahab, king of Israel, Jehoshaphat, being then king of Judah, Jehoram, the son of Jehoshaphat, king of Judah, became king. All right, did you notice in there there's a guy named Joram, and there's a guy named Jehoram. So, the name game. There are several kings right now with the same names that are two different people, right? 2 Kings chapter 1, verse 17. We're backing up in time. Ahaziah died. The same verse, middle of it. Because he had no son, Jehoram became king in his place in the second year of Jehoram, the son of Jehoshaphat. So we have a king in the north and a king in the south. Both of them are named Jehoram. Okay, that's not the only example. Chapter 1, verse 17, there's a guy named Ahaziah in the north. Chapter 8, verse 25, in the 12th year of Joram, the son of Ahab, king of Israel, Ahaziah, the son of Jehoram, king of Judah, began to reign. Now, these two, I'm not saying are reigning at the same time. I'm just saying when you're reading through your Bible, you've got suddenly two people very close to each other named Ahaziah. They are not the only example. Chapter 11, verse 2, there will be a guy named Joash. Jehosheba, the daughter of king of Joram, sister of Ahaziah, took Joash, the son of Ahaziah. Okay, so Ahaziah dies, and Athaliah kills all the brothers, and then there's this little guy named Joash. But in chapter 13, in the northern kingdom, verse 10, in the 37th year of Joash, king of Judah, Jehoash, the son of Jehoahaz, became king over Israel. But in verse 12, the rest of the acts of Joash, which he did in his might, with which he fought against Amaziah, king of Judah. Okay. So we have people with the same names. But then these same people with their names, as we have seen right here, one guy can have two different names. Here's Joash and Jehoash. They're the same person, right? There's an example. Same with the guy in the south. The same thing happens. Also, Jehoram, in chapter 1, verse 17, remember that's where it started here. In the second year of Jehoram, the son of Jehoshaphat, the king of Judah. Well, in chapter 8, verse 16, this guy, in the fifth year of Joram, the son of king of Israel. Okay, so I'm not even going to bother to explain what I just did. I made a little mistake, if you noticed. But the names are the same. The point I'm making is the same. So we've got Jehoram, his name, Joram. Okay, so this is fun to read through your book and look at all these different names and say, wait a minute, I thought I read about him. No, he was in the northern kingdom. I've got this name down here. Oh, they're the same name. Wait a minute, what's going on? Just let me go on for a second. Okay, 2 Chronicles, there's going to be a guy named Jehoahaz who is also named Ahaziah, all within just verses of each other. All right, so we've got different names. Then we have the same time, different time, no time difference at all. In 2 Kings 1:17, listen to this. 2 Kings 1:17, Ahaziah died according to the word of the Lord which Elijah had spoken. And because he had no son, Jehoram became king in his place in the second year of Jehoram, the son of Jehoshaphat, king of Judah. So Jehoram in Judah is reigning for 2 years, already reigning 2 years, when Jehoram becomes king in the northern kingdom. But in chapter 8, verse 16, in the fifth year of Joram, the son of Ahab, which is in the northern kingdom, Jehoshaphat being king of Judah, Jehoram, the son of Jehoshaphat, became king in Israel. So in chapter 1, Jehoram in the south had been king for 2 years when Jehoram in the north becomes king. But in chapter 8, Jehoram in the north had been king for 5 years when Jehoram in the south becomes king. What's going on? All right, several things are going on. But the one that's most important is there are some things called co-regencies. Co-regents. Two kings. Two kings reigning at the same time. Okay? Father gets old. Like even with David, Solomon was anointed king twice before David died. Okay? This happens. All right. Now, at the same time, one more thing. Who's on first in the Bible? 1 Kings chapter 19, verse 16. Jehu is the son of Nimshi. Pretty simple. That's what it says. Jehu, the son of Nimshi. Whereas in 2 Kings chapter 9, verse 2, Jehu, the son of Jehoshaphat. Oh, by the way, there's another Jehoshaphat who is not the same Jehoshaphat as the king. And there's another Jehu who is a prophet that goes and talks to Jehoshaphat. But he's not the same as the Jehu here. However, this Jehu is the son of Jehoshaphat, the son of Nimshi. Whereas in 1 Kings, Jehu is the son of Nimshi. In 2 Kings, Jehu is the son of Jehoshaphat, or the grandson of Nimshi. Okay, all of this tells me several things. If you're going to make some grand, important point off of the names of the 1st and 2nd Kings and 1st and 2nd Chronicles, I'd be very careful. Because, especially, there are a lot of like skeptics annotated Bible. You read through a skeptics annotated Bible, and all through here they're saying, ha ha ha, they use this name over here, this name over here, contradiction, contradiction. No, that's just the way they talk. There was a throne name, there's his personal name. By the way, Ben-Hadad isn't anybody's name. It's a title. Like what? Pharaoh. Pharaoh is a title. Yet they call him Pharaoh. It's all through the Bible. Other people did it. They do it. So, this is, I don't mean to say it's confusion, but be careful. If somebody asserts something, oh, the Bible's not true, look at the genealogies. Well, I wouldn't put too much weight in it to begin with. I wouldn't even worry about it, but not much weight in it. You've had your hand up a long time.
I was just going to say, this is probably one of the many reasons that the Jews paid attention to the genealogies like this. So that they know, you say this name, they're like, wait, which one are you talking about? They say, this guy, it was the son of this guy. That's how they could keep track of who's who,
right?
They're all the names the same.
Right. Here, just a second, Ian. Here, with this one, Nimshi, he's the son of Nimshi here. Here is the grandson of Nimshi. So we understand that they would do these kinds of things, which when we come to the genealogy of Jesus, where it says 14 generations, 14 generations, 14 generations, which doesn't exactly match with 1st and 2nd Chronicles and other places, people assert, oh, there's a contradiction there. No, we have to come to the Bible the way they wrote it, not the way we, with our Western minds, think 1, 2, 3, 4, 5, 6, 7, 8, 9, 10, and then we start over again. Ian.
A lot of this stuff may might have been years between who wrote that particular chronicle.
Yeah. There's all sorts of different there's, you know, when you're reading in one line and it has something similar, like in my chapter 9, verse 7 has and at the end of both of two sentences right in a row. And at the end of two sentences right in a row. And I could just skip one. Oh, there's and. When I look back, I'm writing over here. I look back, I look at the second and I've done homoioteuton, I think it is. Things like this happen all the time with scribes when they're repeating some one vowel sounds. You know, here I say here. Which here do I mean? H-E-A-R, H-E-R-E. You know, things like this happen all the time. That could be it. George?
It seems to me like they're going to be in the opposite direction from the skeptics. If the book was just written by a guy who sat down and wanted to write something, who writes a book and uses the same name for four different characters? I was reading an article about a mathematician who claimed that he could take all his students and have them write out of 1 through 9 digits, okay, write 20 of them down in any random order, and he could pick out, okay, which ones were generated by a computer, which ones weren't, because we make sure there's no pattern or whatever when randomly stuff like that will appear. And it just seems like if we were going to bother fabricating this, you know what I mean? It seems like more factual.
You know, there's on our website, on the church's website, there is a 45-minute long video of the names that are used by the gospel writers. And how what they have done is they've looked at the names and what percentages. Joseph is number one. Every time you write Joseph, or every time you see Joseph, it's the number one Jewish male name in the Gospels. Okay, so what they've done is, because of archaeology, they've looked up, they've been able to count all the times names, Jewish names, are written from the first century in Palestine. And guess what's the number one male name? Joseph. But in Egypt, Alexandria, among the Jewish writings, guess what's not the number one male name? Joseph. What does that tell you about the authors? They knew what the male's number one name was in Palestine. Okay? Now, watch the video. It's absolutely fascinating. It's just another way of substantiating that. The authors may never have been to Israel, but they still knew what they were talking about. Okay, we're rapidly running out of time. Do you have?
George was supposed to, but I don't.
George who?
My brother, but he's not here, so I'll do it.
I meant, do you have a comment or a question?
Oh, I'm sorry.
That's okay. Yeah.